This time on Ask Christian Counseling Associates, join us with special guest Dr. Joe Maiola as we explore the essence of what makes counseling effective and how clients can experience great results when they seek professional help. Welcome, Joe.
Well, thank you.
It's great to have you here today, folks. We have Dr. Joe Maiola. He's been a long time clinical counselor here at Christian Counseling Associates, so we thought we'd bring him along on the podcast today to talk about a whole variety of topics. You know, some episodes, Joe, we have people on to talk about a book or a certain thing, but then we'll bring on staff members to let the public get to know us, and the clients that we serve can come on here and see us. But this, we put the ask in Ask Christian Counseling Associates on these types of episodes. I'm going to cover a whole bunch of topics that I hope people ask questions about. And the goal would be for people to watch this and gain enough interest for them to ask us more questions. And we would promise to come back on this show and answer those questions. So that's what we do sometimes. And we started out at Duquesne University. That's where I met
you.
Yes,
we did.
And that was when was I there? It was around 2001. So it was it was a good 20 years ago at least. So I was a doctoral student. And you were the chair of the counseling program, and you'd been there for I don't know how long before I got there. A long time.
74 I started.
So you were at Duquesne University starting in 1974.
Right.
And there at the heyday of psychology and everything, you were right in the middle of all of that. And then you eventually retired from there, and
after 37 years.
After 37 years, and then came to work at CCA.
Yeah.
So.
Which I might as well get into it right away because that's been something that's been on my mind recently, as I'm working with some of the patients that I work with. And some of them are, going through a lot of anxiety around, whether this is going to happen or whether that's going to happen and so forth. Mm. And as I kept thinking about it, it was like, sometimes I always wonder about coincidence.
Tell me about this show. Coincidence.
I think about coincidence, and it's like, I wonder. Because how did I end up with Christian Counseling Associates? I'm at the end of my career at Duquesne University, looking to retire, checking with a number of agencies and and practitioners and so forth, and saying, I'm ready to retire and I'd like to work a couple of days a week to keep keep my foot in the door and my head going and so on, and
keep your clinical expertise sharp.
Oh, you say that so nicely. But at the time somebody's doing a doctoral thesis, which was the next step of yours. And mm-hmm. I remember calling you up and would you be interested in being on this committee?
Yeah.
And your answer was, if things can work out. And what are the chances of five people being able to get together at the same time and organize this thing and get all the permissions together so that we could have this meeting and you could be on the committee?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember this.
And it all worked out.
Yeah.
And I asked you afterward, what have you done since graduation? And you said, I started Christian Counseling Associates. And I could just, my heart was like, it just filled up. But it was like, and here I am looking around for anything. And I would love to work with that kind of an organization. And
yeah,
was that a coincidence that dissertation came up at that time?
Yeah, we see that as destiny. It was meant to be. Yeah. God had appointed a time that we would work together that way. And
I like to tell the story to my patients when we first start, because I'm convinced that God also decided that I was meant to see them. And that happened back then, and God decided it then. So.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, and I love to tell these stories, so we would tell it to the folks about, you know, you were my dissertation chair. And so that's the final activity or the final requirement is you write this basically like a book of research, and it has to pass through the committee, and then you can graduate. And if you don't do that, it's no go. And there's like a... At the time, there was like a whole group of people who were meeting together to try to complete that. And they'd been there for years. And that happens, you know, a lot of people just don't finish because they don't do their dissertation. Right. So, you know, you had agreed to be the leader of that committee, the chair. And, you know, you taught me the strategy and, you know, pointed me in the right direction, and I graduated. And that was a big deal because, again, plenty of things could go wrong. Yeah, but that, you know, I saw that as, you know, God, you know, giving me a blessing, setting that up for me through you.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so that was 2006. I graduated from Duquesne University. And the next thing that happened, another story I've told you about is that you called me. You were working out at St. Vincent's, and so there was a couple classes during the week that we would go to in Pittsburgh. But then, you know, something really convenient because I lived in Greensburg was I could go all day Saturday. It was partly in Pittsburgh. Yeah, got all my requirements in, and then we would supervise master students at your direction. Right. At St. Vincent. And so there was activity there, and I could, it would save me a trip into Pittsburgh. And once I graduated, I'd just always been, you know, people might ask, you know, what's a PhD program like? Well, for me, it was, I had a full-time job, and then it was about 20 hours a week that I devoted to the PhD process through meetings, traveling around, you know, reading. It was busy. It could be 60 hours plus. But the killer was that all day Saturday, every Saturday. And, you know, the first year, not a big deal. Second year, third year. It's like a marathon. It starts the way, you know. And I often say, like, a lot of people, like I was friends with or people in my family, they, you know, they're like, where were you? Well, I was doing this thing.
The original design of the program was we called it the executive doctoral program, because we wanted to set it up for people who worked, people who were professionals out in the field, and kind of took it after the executive MBA programs that they have. And that's one of the reasons it was like class Saturday classes, Saturday supervision. It was, you know, to set it up for a weekend kind of thing. So
yeah, there was a lot of programs at the time that would say, hey, quit your job. Right. We'll give you some kind of assistantship.
Right.
And that would have been a step backwards for me. At the time, I was a clinical supervisor of an agency, and I couldn't give it up. I was supporting a family. So that was the perfect program at the time. Now, you know, things have changed so much that there's a lot of programs out there. I think Duquesne was one of the only ones at the time that was doing that.
Hey, Joe, could you scoot closer to the mic?
Can I?
Scoot closer.
Get closer. Okay.
You can also bring this back, Joe, like that.
But the, you know, it also brings back memories of how I ended up at Duquesne.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wanted to teach in a university, which is why I went to a doctoral program in the first place. And, you know, as you come to the end of the program, you go to these conferences and so forth, meet people who are hiring. And I'm in Chicago, had interviews at different places. I was New York, South Carolina, and so forth. I'm getting on an elevator to meet, I still remember this, I'm getting on an elevator to go meet with this fella from Iowa, and somebody's waving to me from the back of the elevator. So I stopped, I said, okay, I get off and wait to see who that was. And, well, having gone to Duquesne as an undergrad, the person who was director of student teaching is now the dean of the School of Education. She remembered me.
Yeah.
And that's when she was waving and said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm interviewing for a counselor ed position and so forth. She said, oh, we're going to be having one of those. Do you want it? And I keep thinking back, how did I get that job? Because I got on the right elevator at the right time with the right person on there. It was like another coincidence, right? You know, and again, I was at a time when I was going through all my anxiety of, is anybody going to hire me? Am I going to get this job?
That was like right at the beginning.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I'm glad all that happened. And you know, after I graduated, I remember you called me one day, and this was before the dissertation committee. Mm-hmm. You asked me to go out to St. Vincent. You had something for me to do. And at that time, I mean, we were well-trained, and this is one of the things that the PhD program, you know, gives to you, is that you just say yes to every work assignment, and you're the person who gets it done. And then, you know, to me, like it was other people who weren't getting it done, you know, that's how you stood out, is you took on the project, you got it done for the people who needed it to be done. So I remember, you know, at the time, my family was, you know, it was a Saturday, you know, morning, and you called and said, hey, I got this thing, can you do it? And I was like, yeah, sure, I'll do it. And I hung up the phone, and my wife, Renee, was listening, and she said, well, what did you just do? And it's like I had to wake up and say, wait a second, I'm not a doctoral student anymore. And I really wanted to do it for you, you know, and everything, because that was our relationship. But like having a Saturday off was just like I'd experienced maybe for 2 weeks, and I was like, I need to let that go. So, you know, I called you back, and you were gracious about it, because, you know, people in the university, they act like they're kings and queens. You know, I might be like, I'll never talk to you again. You're like, oh, don't worry about it, we'll do something else later. And then you started calling me on about the dissertation committees, and you know, I travel into Pittsburgh, and I'd have a fun time. You know, at the time, I'd go to the committee. You know, and that was an easy duty. And then I would go over to Bankowitz's, which I did every time I went to Duquesne, you know, on Saturdays. You know, if we had time, we'd go over to Bankowitz's, get a fish sandwich and fried oysters, put a whole bunch of hot sauce on it. And that was just like one of my favorite things.
I remember another time you stopped in my office with a little question. Is if you remember, we were giving Doctor of Education degrees in counseling.
Yeah.
And you said to me, why aren't you giving a PhD? And I'm thinking, well, I'm not sure we're allowed.
Yeah.
So you started the ball rolling on that one. So
to describe to the people, you know, the doctoral program was an EDD,
right.
Doctorate of Education.
Right.
And they were, you know, you really want to go for the PhD. And so yeah, like I said, like, why isn't this a PhD program? Right.
And we, yeah, I was like, well, I'm not sure we're allowed. I thought only our graduate school of arts and sciences could offer the PhD. And so we started the ball. All of a sudden we found out state didn't even care. They said just change it. You know, we sent in a piece of paper that said we wanted to change it, and they said okay.
Yeah.
You know, because they considered them equivalent.
Now, you've told me this story before, but you know, folks, what Dr. Joe is saying is that I'm responsible for making the counseling program at Duquesne University a PhD program.
You got it. So,
I hope that's interesting. It's true. Yeah. So, Good times. Yeah. Like, I'm so glad that that happened. I'm so glad that we got to work together, and I'm so glad that you're here, you know, and here at the podcast today, Joe.
Well, I loved meeting your wife's grandmother, who couldn't wait to meet the guy who is now working for you, who used to be your professor.
When did that happen?
I think it was one of your daughter's graduation or something.
Oh, yeah. 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 Well, and you came to CCA right when we were getting started. So, I mean, we launched CCA in 2009, so 3 years after I graduated. And probably it was like 2010.
And I started in 2010.
Right. Yeah. So that's, you know, 14 years ago. Right. And so a lot of things have happened at CCA since then. Right. And you've.
And then I retired in 2011. Yeah. It was right after that. So I was doing like one night a week with you for, you know, starting when I first started out. And
Yeah. Yeah. Like back then, we had no requirements, no interview process. We just said, okay, you know, but.
Yes, you did.
Well, maybe a little bit. But we, you know, we knew each other. But now it's like highly evolved, you know, system of everything. But
I don't know if you remember this. I think I was your ninth counselor.
Okay.
And I came to you and I said, I don't understand your roster. It's all done by alphabetical, by first names. How do you keep track of it?
So our staff manual had a directory organized by first names because there was only nine people here at the time.
You said to me, you said, well, we know everybody. There's only nine of us, you know. Yeah. Now how many are there?
But I went back home and I changed it. That was the beginning of organization by last names.
How many counselors are there now?
Well, we have, it's 100, I'd say it's like 120 counselors. Is that right? About 120. And then we have about 15, like administrative staff. And, so we were meeting in Newstown at the time. We were like two locations, and now we have over 80 in four states. Yeah. We're about to open it in a fifth. So we're going to be opening in Arkansas very soon. Maybe by the time that you're hearing this podcast, that will be true.
Yeah, I remember there was New Stanton, Greensburg, and I'm not sure if there was one in Latrobe or anything. And then I came on, and all of a sudden we now started in Allegheny County. Yeah. I'm still in Port View.
So, yeah, you're in the Port View office, right, in the McKeesport area, for people who don't know Port View. And you're also in Upper St. Clair.
Right.
Yeah. And, folks, we're looking for Pittsburgh locations. We're always looking to expand in and around the greater Pittsburgh area. And we need good church partners. Anybody listening to this who'd want to get us into their churches, Joe is, Dr. Joe is in the Pittsburgh area. He could be your counselor. what do we want to talk about today? What are the questions that people are asking? And, you know, maybe I would throw this one out here that, because we spend a lot of time on college campuses, you know a lot about that. And they're saying that there's a mental health crisis on college campuses. We just did a podcast with somebody. She's up north, and she's a chaplain, and she's talking about just the dramatic rise in people reporting mental health disorders, people becoming suicidal, people struggling to complete their degrees. And I just wondered, you know, what was that? What did you see during your time? I mean, you know, this is 2011, so it's maybe different than now. Mm-hmm. But what do you think this is all about? Causes and cures.
It's kind of interesting because I think it's more than just college campuses. I think it's in education in general. And as I look around in the high schools, elementary schools, and we're also at that time, we're at a certain time of year. I remember when I was first starting to do research, especially around suicidal behavior and so on, and learned that the most suicide attempts are in the month of April. And you know, I started thinking about that, and I'm trying to think, well, what's that all about? And I started to realize it's people coming out of winter, had all through all the doldrums, and now everything's coming back to life. Yeah. You know, nature's coming back to life, and they're not. And you know, maybe I could wait it through the winter. We're supposed to be through the doldrums in the winter. And you know, I start seeing that, and then reading about, you know, there's more and more depression and more even all kinds of mental health issues, acting out behaviors and so on.
Yeah.
And we're seeing more and more.
So it could be like a seasonal affective disorder. And we could explain it that way. I think the theme
just
here.
Just a different season. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
springtime.
I think, yeah, it was springtime.
Yeah.
So maybe, yeah, I think the theme here is that it's like reaching way past that. And, you know, we're hearing of all kinds of things going on campuses that are new in the last 10 years. And I don't know if you've...
Shootings. And,
yeah, yeah, you've had shootings. I remember when I was, you know, so I taught for University of Pittsburgh for 10 years. And it was on the Greensburg campus here. And like maybe like halfway through that 10-year, they started coming with these door stops that you had to install. You know, you had to tell the students, like, I can install this door stop. So if there's a shooter in the hallway, then they can't get in because it'll jam the door. And that was our crisis plan. And I just had to think to myself, I mean, we didn't have any crisis plan when I was a student. It was... You didn't even think of that, but they wanted us to think about and know that. And I went back to the students and I said, how many of you feel safe knowing that I'll jam this door? If there's any kind of problem, I will protect you. And you know, there was, you know, like half the class raised their hands and then half didn't. Yeah, they had doubt that I could protect the room. Yeah.
Well, I go back into other forms of higher ed, like, you know, career and technical schools and so forth, and I look around at their accreditation standards. Most schools are required to have a crisis plan in place as part of their accreditation to include, you know, be it a shooter to if there's a flood or whatever. I mean, there's, and it really has to be, I'm lost for a word there, but it has to really be able to cover all kinds of different possibilities.
When I was at Duquesne, I remembered the, very clearly, like 9/11 had just happened, and I was at a meeting. And I was sitting at the table with some professors, and we were talking about what it was really all about and what was going on. And I just started to realize that, you know, there was differing viewpoints on, you know, every bit of reality of how to handle things. So I remember just being, you know, sitting at the table with people who were definably, in my mind, liberal, you know, thinkers. And they just, you know, they're describing 9/11 in a way that was foreign to me.
Didn't they for a while after that they had it's like code orange, like level orange. There's like there'll be a terrorist attack, and then like because they were like sending out signals to the public.
Threat levels.
Yeah. And I mean that's a kind
of. I forgot about that.
It's like almost like
we're on an orange today. It's an orange threat level.
Like
orange.
But then
it's like 30% chance I'll die today.
so you notice like that using that language and kind of how you're talking about like crisis planning on campuses starts to like that people behave in accordance to that language. That's like you know people. We constantly have to advertise, have a crisis plan. And then you're always thinking about crisis and like what to do. And now you're like, it's more in your mind now than it would be before.
Yeah, I started to notice, and it's probably like too long ago for me to go back to specific conversations that started to happen, but certain things were being downplayed that I felt was important, and then certain things were being upplayed, and it just started into the world of like, you know, taking every event and making it political, and it was very psychological at the same time. When I think of the threat, you know, rating system, I just think of how, like, we're just telling people, like, how scared do you have to be today? It didn't help me in any way. Like, it just was telling me, today you need to be really scared. And I automatically just got a sense of, like, how ridiculous this is. Like, I don't need you to tell me anything. You know, and I didn't listen to you the day before this happened, and I'm not listening to you now. And so, you know, the thing that happens to me to this day that I really have a problem with is educators who will come to me and say, we're going to tell you how this is going to be safe. And they give me this door jam. And I'm like, what the heck is this thing? Get this away from me. But they're upset. You know, they're not giving it to me because it's going to make me safe. They want me to do it. And if I don't do it, now I'm in trouble. And, you know, we go around to all these, you know, these educators say, if you don't follow my rules, you know, you can't be here. And they have a whole bunch of rules, and some of them are just completely ridiculous. And it's all done in the guise of, well, we have to do this because you are going to be protected. Okay. You know, so.
Well, I'm going to change the story a little bit.
Okay.
And get away from, you know, I don't know about mental health on campuses as yep. much as thinking about the biggest changes that I've seen on campuses. I remember the days of academic freedom and the days in terms of, you know, you were responsible for your curriculum and all these kinds of things.
Sure.
And then all of a sudden, I don't know where the change came from. But we went from, and I like to call that leadership. You know, I think there's a big part of leadership that requires, yeah, you got to do some management. Yeah, we have certain rules. We have certain kinds of things that need to be followed. And sometimes you need to make rules. But the other side of it is, you know, leadership, you know, basically is built around the fact that this is what I need from you. And I trust you to do it. You know, and I provide you every opportunity to grow and do this so that, you know, you own this thing. And it's become more and more, I keep seeing more micromanagement. Yeah. This is how you're supposed to do it and so forth. And I see that, you know, I was active with accreditation.
Mm-hmm.
We were one of the, I think we were the third school in Pennsylvania to get KCREP accredited.
KCREP is the most important credential for counselors, by the way, if you're wondering what that is.
As far as their school is concerned, because it accredits the training program.
Yeah.
And in terms of looking at it, the standards were real broad at first. And more, it was like real specific. You had to have, they told me how to have what my syllabus was supposed to look like.
Yeah.
You know,
it's true. So academic freedom is thrown away,
right.
Essentially, in that you have this, this leadership of people, educators who are super controlling. And it all comes, you know, under the umbrella of, we're protecting you. You need to let us do yeah. this. And, you know, I started feeling like a child in that. Like, I don't know. Do I need you? Do I? And, you know, maybe this is, you know, critical thinking, you know, or sarcastic, but I'd always be like, I don't think that you could protect anybody. So, like, and, you know, I'd have people, you know, if somebody handed me a syllabus, I would instantly think, why don't you teach class? Do you want to do that? That's not where I was going. And I think that, like, what you're saying is directly correlates to our, you know, what we're doing to the students, where we tell them, you need to be anxious, you need to be afraid, you know, here's whatever, we're going to tell you exactly what to do, And they get the sense of, wow, this just means that I'm not safe because these people are in control and I'm not. And then, we, you know, with the advent of like, okay, I'm, if I was in the counseling department, I'm telling people that there's this puppy room that they need to go to when they're anxious. And I don't know if I sound mean when I say that I don't like the puppy room. I mean, I like puppies. I like cats. So, you know, they're cuddly. Yeah. They're nice. But when I was on campus as a student, they're like, you better get this done or you're going to fail and you're out. And then I'd think about like my parents. Oh, I'd go tell my parents like that I failed this class. And that's what I'd be afraid of. Like if I don't work hard enough. And now it's sort of flipped, like there's all these other things that we're telling people that they have to be afraid of. And it's sort of, you know, I just like, you know, as a 20-something guy, I would just feel sort of wimpy having to go pet a little puppy. Even though, again, I like puppies. You know? And I think that, you know, like the way that I was brought up is, you know, you keep on doing that kind of stuff, you'll be sort of like wimpy in your mind. Yeah.
Well, I think what, you know, we're talking about, like, is as far as like with the threat levels and in terms of mental health, is like we stopped, you know, accepting the possibility of risk or the ability of, you know, feeling any discomfort. You know, it's like you can't feel any anxiety, so you have to go to the, you know, the puppy room. You know, we had to start making those things available because any anxiety was unacceptable. You know, having any level, you know, was not a thing that you could have.
Yeah, and it goes along with, I mean, I was at Asbury University. You know, I have family members who are you know, in attendance there, and you know, Abby, my daughter, goes there. She's going to graduate next year, and they brought in like a superintendent of schools who's telling me that there's kitty litter boxes in the bathrooms in his school district, and I'm just like, this is just crazy. You know, how could we tell kids that they could do this? And it's an extension. Like, that's, you know, first we have the puppy room, and then we go to the cat litter in the bathroom. And we're telling kids all kinds of things, super controlling things, you know, when you think about it, like telling them how to be. And I don't think that was around when I was coming up.
Well, I see it in therapy now. I'm used to I remember toward the end of the career, I had a student come up to me and he was like, you know, you always said to us you wanted to know what I think. Well, I've heard that for years. He says, and I know better. He says, and I can't handle working with you because you really mean it.
Yeah.
Because the idea is, it's really not what you think. It's what he's got to give me the answer I want. And I see that in therapy. It's, you know, I really, that's a big part of building the trust and rapport, is the part that comes to, no, you can tell me what you think and it's okay. And
that's the way it was. And now, you know, to me, and this is the really unhealthy part, and I think it is, it's very depressing. It's very pessimistic and defeating, where it's really, you know, in academia, it's not about being the best. It's about whose side you're on. And if you're on the wrong side, if you're thinking the wrong things, then you're bad. And if you think the right things, or you ascribe to the right, you know, philosophy or politics, it doesn't matter if you're good or bad. That's what's going to make you successful. And so there's just, it's become very complicated. And if I have a lot of gifts and a lot of thoughts that I finally get to share in life, and I get to this place and it's just a new group of people telling me how to be like I'm a kid, I couldn't think of anything more depressing to find out in early adulthood.
Well, and let's get into the therapeutic process. What do we do? Our job there is to help people in terms of understanding how to make decisions for themselves. Yeah. And, you know, the biggest process in the decision-making process is recognizing there's options and helping somebody to understand, you know, what those options are, because they're looking for the right answer. They're looking for the right answer. And I don't know how long, many times it takes before they get it. There is no right answer. There's a best answer. Yeah. Because there's going to be advantages and disadvantages to all your options.
Yeah.
And
well, again, we're about, you know, things well, people ask questions
well,
about.
Well, before I finish on that, though.
Yeah.
And then I remind them where there are right answers is when you're making decisions around morality.
Right. There's a right and wrong.
Because I've got some rules over here that tell me what's right and what's wrong, what's true and what's a lie. But other than that, it becomes, you know, what's best.
Yeah.
And of course, then they have to deal with pleasing everybody, because this one tells you to do this and this one tells you that.
Well, it's funny, like so the question that people would ask is, you know, what's the best counseling approach? Or maybe that would trickle down into a question of when they come to counseling, what do I really need to do in counseling? And there maybe they've answered the question before they get here, because again, it's the answer's been given to you, and so moving on from college campuses to what we're telling people will help them.
My office. Okay.
So now you're in the college counseling office. Now what? Here, so the question is, you know, what is really effective? And the mental health field has all these things that they try to give to people. But, I would, in my mind, to start off this conversation, I'm going to give you a couple examples, see what you think about it. There's two major branches in psychology nowadays. One is the symptom reduction crowd, to say what we really need to do for you is make you feel better. And then on the other side, the side that I like obviously is we need to be able to face reality. We need to face the reality of our lives, and that's over here. These two camps don't get along. But, you know, if you're going to counseling, you'll notice, counselors are maybe doing both. Some approaches are truly just symptom reduction. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're depressed, we need to get you to a place where you don't feel depressed anymore and you right. never feel depressed again.
Yeah. Well, here's where I want to add a third.
Okay.
And that's the Christian counselor. And to me, the Christian counselor is somebody who recognizes there's a difference between being happy and being joyful.
Yeah.
Happiness, and I looked it up in a dictionary one time. It's a state of mind. You think you're happy. And we can do things. How do we make people happy? You give them something they want. And why is happiness so tentative? Well, because once you have it, why would you want something you have? I don't want it anymore. I have it. So now I want something else, and I want something else. And I'll go back to that, you know, when I think about God and how many places in the Bible God will take care of what you need, mm-hmm. not what you want.
Yeah, and that's reality. It's God's reality.
And God's reality is God has three things for us: joy, peace, and love. And, you know, if I'm putting it into, from my Christian perspective, I'm trying to help somebody in terms of understanding what it means to be joyful. They're free. God gave us a free will. You can make choices for yourself. You don't have to please me. You don't have to please anybody else. You're free. And so one of the things I try to do is, I love this word, but you know, I'm old and I come from a training background that's from the 60s and 70s. And, you know, back, you know, I was into a lot of phenomenology, which was built around
existential
experience. No, just
phenomenology.
Well, that was something else, which I don't even agree with, because I don't think the two can go together.
Okay.
But phenomenology is built around, these are your experiences. And your experiences affect the decisions you're going to make. So if I've had these experiences, it's going to have a certain effect here and a certain effect here. So to help somebody to, first of all, understand how their experiences are affecting them, we like to call it a phenomenal field. This is what they see. How do I broaden that so that they have different kinds of experiences? And I'm over there telling, well, if you want to do that, go ahead. I mean, no one's going to stop you. Or, you know, things that they tell me they can't do, or they shouldn't do, or they have to do. And just to try to understand that kind of thing, because when they get to the point where they can say, I won't do it, or I will do it, now they're using their free will. And, you know, and again, when I feel free, then I can find peace and so forth. I quote Philippians a lot. Chapter 4 of Philippians, especially...
Chapter 4 of Philippians.
Yeah, starting with...
I want to bring that up.
Starting with verse 4. But it really tells us a lot about what anxiety is about. And he starts off, you know, we don't have to be anxious depending on the... Who, you know, with whatever the.
So let me read this if we can, and we'll bring up the what version are you going to give us? The NIV. Can we get the NASB 1995?
And move us now to verse 4.
Verse 4. So. So this
is there we go.
This is we've talked about this before, but this would be good to you know, this is, there's a lot of psychology in this.
Yes.
And you know, I'd have to be honest with you. The phenomenology, like I understand the existential part, but you're saying you want to keep the existential part away, but the phenomenology part I have not a lot of understanding about. And you've talked about it before. I get what you're saying. Yeah. You know, I would sort of take a different approach, but you know, these are the kinds of things where there's truth about, you know, what we need to see in life, how we need to face that. It's by God's design, and He gives us a choice. We can do it His way or not.
Existentialism is built around freedom, and it's built around freedom. And if you look at the therapeutic approaches, because I mean, you really have to do something that you feel good with. And if you look at the therapeutic approaches, you know, they're built around insight. People have insights. Well, the phenomenologist says it's built around experiences. And if I'm built around insight, yeah, that is freedom and so forth. I'm looking at something that's pretty deterministic. If my choices are based upon what my experiences are, I've already been determined what I'm going to choose, unless somebody comes and gives me some new kind of experience. But if we look up here, four through 10, it's
We have the Huggies commercial.
Rejoice in the Lord, and I say rejoice. You know, you don't have to be anxious, because you ask God for what you need. With a prayer, you know, with a prayerful heart. And then here's where I think it's really important, and this is where I think people miss out. So we'll go away from that for a second. I mentioned before the way I look at the world and look at life, there's really little right and wrong. It's, you know, what's the best thing to do? God created us in God's image and likeness. We weren't created to be gods. Therefore, none of us are perfect. we are the creatures, we imperfect beings, who really develop this physical world of ours. The world's not going to be perfect. And therefore, you know, you look at everything, it's going to have their advantages and their disadvantages. And Paul's pointing out in there, you know, you can look at things in terms of what's wholesome and good and so forth.
Yeah.
Because those would be the advantages. But I could also look at what's the disadvantages. And I think he writes a mystery here. I like to have fun with this because, you know, he says if you look at the advantages in terms of what you're doing or where you are, the God who gives you peace will be with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's, well, if I look at those disadvantages, I'm looking at chaos. And who's the prince of chaos?
The devil.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what happens when people get anxious.
Well, let me read out this verse because this is a very central to Christian counseling, yeah, and one that we teach at CCA, and we teach people to really let this weigh in our hearts in our counseling. Yeah. You know, so Philippians 4, starting in verse 4, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. Let your gentle spirit be known to all men. The Lord is near. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Now let's stop there at that first part, and you know, this is supporting what you're saying, Joe. It is telling us something, and then at the end, it's saying if we're doing this, if we're engaged in this, if this is our experience, you know, I take this as a promise. The Lord will guard your hearts and your minds. Now that's a very important thing to a counselor. Like if I'm going to say, you know, what's the best we can do is to have protection over our minds and our hearts. The heart is the core of who you are, you know, your sense of identity, everything, like where that is shaped. And right here it's saying, okay, if this is your experience, if this is what you're doing, if you're acting according to this, I'll give you protection. And that's, you know, reality is that there's no guarantee that we don't go, you know, that we'll be mentally healthy in this world. You know, I'd say it's a fallen world, and so messed up things happen. You have messed up actors in it. And so people can get hurt. We should be careful. And God says he'll protect us. And here's the way to protect your mind. Rejoice. Rejoice always. Well, how can you do that? And the preceding verse says, well, be very gentle. And I would take that to be, you know, be very careful, you know, about, you know, in your spirit, like have a discerning spirit, you know, let that be known, like that, you know. And here's the next verse. We've debated this a lot, but this would be my take on it. I hope I'm not on theologically shaky ground. What does it mean? Why does it say there, the Lord is near? You know, be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. Well, you know, to me, this is the way that I take it. And again, you know, theologians out there, ask us questions, send us emails. I'm willing to hear you on this. We have a choice. We have free will. We can rejoice. How? The Lord is here with us as two believers gathered together. He promises to be. But he's also doing things in this world. He has dominion over everything. And so that's the good that is in the world, is what he is doing. And we can look for that, you know, with gentleness. Like we can be very careful to keep our eyes on that. And that's where, you know, the verses 8.
That's, you know, why I like to go to 8, because that to me is where the real meat is.
Right.
This in terms is of
finally, brethren.
True and honorable and right. Because I can look at the other side, too.
Right.
The other thing, though, I like people to recognize, especially with that therapeutic process, and that's why I'm saying, you know, you're saying that there was two schools. Well, I want to put the third school in there. It's Christian.
Yeah.
And, you know, and as I look at that, it's like, you know, again, I can look at that the other side. I can look at what's not honorable. And sometimes I will.
Yeah.
That's why I get anxious. And that's when I say, you know, that's going to cause me chaos. And
yeah, you could let your mind gravitate towards what is good, or you could let it gravitate towards the chaos, and you have a choice. Both is there at the same time. So the choice is available to you. Here's where I would say, like,
well, before we go,
yeah,
I literally like to remind people you're not going to always be anywhere, you know, because that would be perfection.
Right. You don't have to do it perfectly.
And we're not perfect. What's important is, well, when I catch myself doing these things and being able to catch myself so that I can swing back.
Yeah.
But go to 13.
Yeah, so it says, you know, and again for our audience, I'll just read through 8. You know, finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute or good reputation, if there is any excellence, if anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. The things you've learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. And going to 13, I can do all things through him who strengthens me.
I wonder who the hymn was.
Yeah. So, you know, in this version, it's capitalized. H is because it's
so
the Lord.
I guess I know who that is.
And, you know, you can do this only because the Lord made it possible. You would not choose it if if it was just your choice. So no reason to be boastful here. You know, God gives you the choice, and he gives you the ability to make the choice. And here's the design is that, rejoicing also to me, you know, as we say, rejoice in the Lord always, going back to verse 4, is prizing, cherishing, valuing over all things what the Lord will give and the direction that he takes us. And so prizing these things in verse 8, filling your minds with those things, that strengthens the mind. Now, you know, my argument here is the symptom reduction stuff is like pop psychology that you should not accept from your counselor. You should not let somebody tell you that you're going to feel good all the time. You're going to, you know, the goal is to be happy. The goal is to never be depressed again. All of that is impossible. It's just not true. Over here, to seek joy in your life, the joy that the Lord has for you. You know, to focus on the things, you know, in verse 8 that the Lord has for you. To realize that that is what life is. And in that way, glorify the Lord. Rejoice in him. You know, and have a counselor who will help you do that, because we have all kinds of desires that we have to choose from, and without the help of people around you, you're not going to get there. And there's going to be trouble. Like, we're going to make bad choices. You know, and we're not going to be perfect, and the Lord understands that. And we can trust the Lord to help us get there. He will make it possible, and that is the strong mind.
The bad choices are things that I call sin.
Yes.
And when I think about it, here we are, it's Holy Week.
By the time people are watching, it's going to be after Holy Week.
Well, it's Wednesday of Holy Week.
It was Holy Week. Easter is this Sunday while we're taping this, folks.
And the day after tomorrow is the day when, when I think about sin, and the good Lord reminded us, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Yeah, sometimes we do make those choices. Yeah. You know, I'm embarrassed to say this, but I think I was 40 before I realized that he wasn't just talking about soldiers that were stabbing him and all that. He was talking about Joe Maiola.
You have to really let that into your mind, that we can trust the mercy of God, and that that is sufficient, you know, and we, you know, so all of those kinds of things to me, that's going on in vulnerable times, you know, so what do I need to get out of counseling? What is the best approach? Here would be my answer. It is one that is foundationally Christian. Like you're saying, it's Christian counseling. That's what we would guide people to choose. You know, Christian counseling is nothing more than, you know, in your mind and your heart going by God's design. And there's a, you know, if you want to call that psychology, you can, because even if I was just to tell you I'm a scientist, which I am, you know, I would tell you that approach has great results. In fact, the best results. And the problem is that you people could point to it and say, well, you know, this person went to do this way and they went crazy. Well, you know, because this is not, you know, because we're not perfect and the world is a broken place, you know, we really have to answer this kind of question. Like, how do I deal with things in my mind and my heart?
Hi, I'm Dr. Rich Hoffman, president of the Foundation for Christian Counseling. This year, we invite you to our upcoming fundraisers in April. In 2024, our foundation experienced remarkable growth, broadening our reach and impact. I'm humbled and excited to announce that, effective as of January 1st, Concepts of Truth International has joined the foundation, uniting our efforts to offer compassionate support and guidance to those in need. Concepts of Truth is renowned for its life-affirming National Crisis Call Center, providing confidential counseling to women and families affected by trauma from reproductive loss, such as abortion, miscarriage, or for those actively facing a pregnancy decision. We are there at the point of contact. Through God-honoring support, we aim to reassure these individuals that the church stands by them in their time of need. Additionally, Concepts of Truth delivers Christ-centered sexual health programs to churches and schools nationwide, advocating for stronger, healthier families in our communities.
Hi, I'm Millie Lace, founder of Concepts of Truth International. For over 20 years, our call center has been a beacon of hope for thousands of women and families. Our mission has expanded globally since becoming an NGO at the United Nations in 2015, where we uplift our Christian identity and life-affirming principles on an international platform. In 2022, our prayers were answered, praise God, with the overturning of Roe v. Wade, sparking a positive shift in the abortion discourse in our nation. Now, with the merger with the Foundation for Christian Counseling, I am humbled and excited to see a new chapter unfolding as we carry our mission forward for generations to come. Every year, the FFCC raises funds to offer counseling grants to individuals and families in need of support. These grants are filling the gap and serving as a pathway for people to engage Christian counseling services, giving them an opportunity for transformation and personal growth.
In conjunction with our merger with Concepts of Truth, the Foundation is excited to announce an expansion of our international mission to Liberia. This year, our counseling program, CCA Liberia, plans to acquire an initial 40 acres of farmland to launch our agricultural development initiative. This will serve as the cornerstone of our services in our Liberia program, empowering those in a challenging environment to enact sustainable initiatives that rebuild their nation's economy after being devastated by years of civil war. At the Foundation for Christian Counseling, we're inspired by the opportunities presented to us in 2024, and we invite you on this journey. Attend our three auction dinners and the Concepts of Truth annual gala. Your partnership is crucial. Join us, and with God's help, we will transform communities one family at a time.
Well, I keep thinking, and just a couple of things, because I do want to get back to some other things around anxiety.
Yep.
But I keep thinking about, you know, this life of ours here on earth, this isn't heaven, but it's also not hell. It's that place that's somewhere in between. And if we're going to talk about spiritual warfare, this is where it is. This is the good and the evil. And, you know, I just think about it. You know, when when I think about wars, and wars are made up of many battles. Well, yep, I'm going through them also. I'm having this war, and I've got this battle, you know, for whatever it may be, purity or something.
What battles are you going through, Joe?
That's none of your business.
You don't want to talk about it. I'm a counselor.
And I'm free to talk about what I want.
No.
But when I think about those different, but there are many battles, and one of the things I hope people get is, you know, the where warfare is most successful was you win some, but you never lose. You retreat and figure out how to win the next one. And that's really what we're trying to do in a counseling process. Yeah, you're going to mess up sometimes. But when I mess up sometimes, you know, Paul tells us in Romans, that's what helps us grow. And, you know, we have the things of the flesh that die in the flesh. I joke with people sometimes. I said, you know, only the pharaohs were able to take all the stuff with them. Well, we found out that wasn't true either. But, you know, but it's in the spirit. Duquesne University, we'll go back there, the university motto, it's the spirit that gives life. We grow in the spirit because it's the spirit that will live on. And, we grow from missteps. I can't pass it up. When I think of life, I think of Frank Sinatra and his old song called That's Life. You know, you're riding high in April and shot down in May, but that'll be back on top in June. And, you know, and some people get their kicks stomping on your dreams. And
like the Italian ethnic flavor that you bring to the Frank Sinatra reference. We weren't expecting that, but it's true. I like Frank Sinatra.
Well, I also, I'll use a lot of songs sometimes. And, you know, we talked about forgiveness a minute ago. Forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. And I point out to people a lot of times, you know, forgiveness is one thing. Forgetting is another. Mm. It's the inability to forget is what triggers us, traumatizes us, brings things back, and why we wonder why we get triggered sometimes. Yeah. Well, I may have forgiven you, but that doesn't mean I forgot. Mm. And, you know, and I see you doing something.
Yeah, we don't forget.
Yeah.
You know, so that brings me, let me share another, you know, thing with you. We recently did an EMDR training here. Mm. You know, so I've been doing eye movement desensitization and reprocessing for a long time. I got trained back, probably before 2000. I mean, it was a long time, so at least 20 years. We get calls all the time, I'm traumatized. I have this memory. It's locked in my mind. And the only thing that's going to help me is EMDR. Now, I would just tell the public out there, what's truly effective for trauma? And I would say that there's many different ways to approach that, and there's some pretty like studied kind of things. Mm-hmm. And I've always been amazed by the devotion to the EMDR approach, saying it's the best thing out there. And if you look at the research, it's not the best thing. It's one of the things that works efficiently, and it doesn't work all the time. So we study, what is the best way to approach each person, and we personalize it. But people assume I'm going to get into this eye movement and desensitization, and it's gonna, I don't think that people really know what it is, but at CCA we train every, we're you know, on the road to train everybody here. Now, we still have counselors who are learning this approach, but I would tell you that, you know, it's that devotion, like it almost gets to like a fad in the counseling. Like the counselors, you know, oh, this is the best thing ever. And those kind of things come along. So one of the things that just what we're talking about is there's these foundational things that you have to do with anxiety and trauma. And if you studied them scientifically, you would see that these things work reliably. So there's things that the mainstream of our profession want to make important, and then there's things that are just important. So another example so we use EMDR. You know, I endorse that. I think it's very helpful. There's other things that I just think is junk. You know, so emotional freedom technique. We mentioned this before you came on today, EFT for trauma is this idea of tapping. You tap, and if I tap or if I tap here, there's an acupressure point. Now this is where it gets, you know, complicated. You know, so as a Christian, if I was to say, okay, this is what we really, you know, if you were to ask me, what do we really need to do? I hope that you would not expect to say, well, we need to really find out your acupressure points and make sure that when you're anxious, you tap these points and it'll make you feel better. And if you come to me in counseling, I'm going to teach you how to do this, and that's what's going to help. Now, Joe, what would you think about that if I was your counselor and I told you to do that?
Well, this is not going to be a simple answer.
Okay.
I got my first counseling job back in 1970, so I've seen a fad or 12 come along. Mm-hmm. And I remember back probably in late 70s, the thing was hydropsychotherapy. And hydropsychotherapy was built around, you know, the first trauma that you have in life is your birth. And you're put in a pool with a bunch of people, and you're going through the birth canal, floating through it, and then somebody...
So you're traumatized when you're born.
You got it. And
we're going to reenact
that. So we reenact that, and people are going to... That's going to get you out of it. Well, another form of hydropsychotherapy, they had these tanks, you know, deprivation chambers that were filled with... salt water.
And that's coming back. They have something that now.
Yeah. But they were filled with salt water, and there was a room temperature, body temperature, so you have no sensation whatsoever, and you reenacted even before you were born. You know, and then...
So while you're in the womb, you were traumatized.
Yes, and it went on and on. And in the process, you know, I'm not so sure people really even understand the things that do traumatize them. And how we get traumatized almost every day. You know, I flunked this exam. Or my girlfriend just broke up with me. I mean, they're traumatic.
You're traumatized.
You've got it. And, you know, and again, those are the things that, you know, to me, trauma and dealing with the trauma is built around the memory. We don't forget. And again, we don't forget that's going to affect that. We go back to that phenomenal field. This is part of my experience.
Well, and I agree with what you're saying, you know, and it's wise. And I've heard you talk about the Duquesne days before, and this is a good theme for us because we, you know, it's part of this presentation and everything. But I remember you telling me about the rebirthing chamber, you know, and I was traumatized at birth, and I'd have people in the pool. At this special weekend seminar, and there would be stories of people who had these like deep revelations. It was like I was born again in the pool at Duquesne, and I was shaking and I was crying, and you know, we see testimonials of people like, I've never experienced anything like this. This was the best thing ever.
Yeah.
And then they go out and they're like a train wreck.
Exactly.
And that's the point I would make about this for people who know what this is. And I hope our counselors are listening to this, and a lot of other counselors too, because we'll send this out to everybody. But emotional freedom technique is based on the Chinese theory of energetic meridians. This is, I'm going to read this paragraph about what this is about. Chinese medicine believes that we all have meridians, which are energetic pathways that run through our bodies, similar to how blood runs through our veins. When we're sick, those meridians are blocked. To heal, needles are placed in specific acupuncture points on the body to unblock the energy to restore health. Tapping, which I mentioned is part of the EFT or the emotional freedom technique, uses energetic meridians, except tapping with your fingers is done on the specific energy points instead of using needles. So, and then you can go to a training as a counselor, tapping made easy, and learn these points, and then tell the people coming to counseling here, tap on these points. Now, this is the point I would make, is that if they've studied this in some research articles, and they found it to have some type of effect. And you have people out there and say, I'm tapping, and it really makes me feel better. And then they go out and they're like a train wreck. Or they go out and that's the way they manage life. Now, as a Christian person, I would say the Christian community has all kinds of problems with this. About controlling energy. And I'd say in fairness that I talk about birth. I was my mom, and she tells this story on public, so she wouldn't mind me telling it. She probably won't watch this podcast, but again, I have permission. I was born, she wasn't under anesthesia at all. The doctors at whatever hospital in Pittsburgh said, we'll give you the option to use acupuncture, that we can take away the pain through these acupuncture points. And so the story goes that there was all these people watching in the medical doctors studying this. And I was born through acupuncture instead of, with the aid of general anesthesia. I was very traumatized. but it was effective. My mom said it worked.
Yeah.
And if you study these things, the science would say that the science of acupuncture, has a good medical effect. If you study acupressure, it would work. Now, what we don't see, and what the general public, I would encourage everybody to realize, is it isn't like this is the cure for depression. That now that we understand acupressure and we're having people tapping, they've gone on to have wonderful lives. I mean, it's so dramatic that don't come to counseling anymore. Read this book on acupressure. You're going to be just fine.
My response to this, I'm not an educator. An educator works with your mind. Mm-hmm. I'm not a physician. Physicians work with your body.
Yeah.
I'm a counselor. I work with you emotionally. And as a Christian counselor, I also work with you spiritually.
Yeah.
And if I'm going to be dealing with your body, I'll save that for the doctors. If I'm dealing with whether you learn how to be, not anxious, I'll save that for some teacher or guru or whatever you want to call them. I'm over here for you to find, your own freedom, your own peace, your joy, and your love. And I'll go back to that decision-making process. How do I determine the best of my options? Well, why does the Holy Spirit give us these gifts of wisdom, understanding, knowledge, advice from others, and being open to God so that we can determine what's the best answer? And why does the Holy Spirit give us the gift of courage so that we can follow through on the best because we know there's going to be disadvantages too.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, what I would say, you know, to clinicians and to clients who are saying, what's the best approach? I mean, that's the question. That all of these, you know, many things have been shown to help with anxiety. You know, and as Christians, we know, you know, and the research would say this too, that involvement, connection to the Christian community, the body of Christ. You know, if you center your life in the church because that's what God is telling you to do, you know, that is clinically been shown to be more effective than tapping, than EMDR. That these people become emotionally sturdy, and in the counseling process, yeah, like we, you know, we start this process of learning how to deal with our thoughts and our emotions, and, you know, where our life is going, like developing, you know, an awareness of that, and we help to really make these decisions. You know, like we're not making the decisions. We help people understand the decisions they need to make to face this anxiety, to face this depression, and that it's going to be lifelong. So this cup, the cups that we're drinking out of today says ABC, always be counseling.
That's right.
And that's our motto at CCA, Christian Counseling Associates, that, and what it means when we say always be counseling, that Christian counseling and all clinical approaches, you know, see that dealing with this kind of stuff is a lifestyle. And that at best, Christian counseling, the help that you'll receive here, which we know is the best, is, you know, this is a modern form of Christian discipleship. It's a modern form of learning together how to do this God's way in our minds and our hearts. And there's things that need to be worked out. And the truth is that we're just the beginning of that. I mean, the real work begins once you've, you know, really become rooted in the church. And you know, so it's Easter week. You know, the whole, you know, churches will be packed.
Yeah.
And we'll have to make a decision after that for us Christers out there, the people who go on Christmas and Easter, whether we're going to keep this going. And whether we're going to come back the following week.
And when you mention the church community, I like to point out certain kinds of things. You know, different denominations have different theology. But if I look at what it means to take communion, taking communion is I accept that God and Christ are in me. They're part of me. I accept that. And then I talk about being in communion. And that's where I see the value of the church. That being in communion means, you know, I'm there and I'm a part of all these fellow believers. Yeah. Who, you know, and that's... And that to me is why, you know, one of the options I'd like to give people is, you know, why don't you regularly go to church?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and we, you know, we in our counseling process, you know, part of dealing with things in mind and heart is to open our minds and our hearts to God's way. You know, that starts with a counselor here, and that we teach you how to be transparent. Yeah. To talk about things in your mind that you wouldn't usually talk about. It becomes more real, and what you have to do with that becomes more real. And then there's transparency, and then there's accountability, which means, you know, we'll work together, you know, and it's your choice. You decide. Nobody's going to decide for you, but you have to decide what is best. And that'll become more clear when we're doing this together and you're not hiding that in your mind, because it becomes lost in your mind too. It becomes out of your sight. But with transparency and accountability, these things become more clear, more manageable. Mm-hmm. Together, it's better. And it's only, you know, we're just a reflection of what you're truly going to find in the church, which is transparency and accountability is a way of life that God designed in the church. And, you know, there's key things like going on Sunday and praising God and being together, but all the other things too, you know, that come along in that design. You know, it starts here in counseling and then it gets practiced for a life, you know, sure. In the church. That's why we say always be counseling. Don't stop when you're not going to come to counseling forever at CCA. And anybody who tells you that, you know, you were born this way and you have to stay here forever, we're not getting anywhere. We're going to get you to a place where you don't need us anymore. And you could do this with, you know, in a more productive way in the church.
And I like to point out sometimes, you know, in terms of counseling, and I kind of alluded to that a little while ago, I don't work with people's heads. You know, that's cognition. I work with people on their emotional and their spiritual sides. And that's the difficult part, because my job is to try to help them understand and accept something that's going to make no sense. Emotions, if emotions make sense, they're not emotions. If spirituality makes sense, it's not spiritual. And how do I develop this acceptance of it? Well, faith, hope, charity.
So maybe switch gears. A couple other things that, you know, want to get your thoughts on. You know, because Dr. Joe, you know, is, you know, by all rights, expert in psychology. You spent your whole career in the space. Yeah. So I have some studies, and we like to make this a little academic because, again, you know, what is the most effective thing in counseling? And I found these maybe studies that would be considered shocking, but overall, and I'll read the statement to you, and this is the effects of counseling. Overall, the meta-analytic reviews of psychotherapy. So again, the question is, what is the most effective thing that my counselor could do with me? Is it EMDR? Is it thought field therapy? Is it, you know, and thought field therapy, I didn't talk about it. I should say emotional freedom technique, the tapping. Overall, the meta-analytic reviews of psychotherapy that have provided correlational data find little evidence for a relationship between experience and outcome. So that was done by Lambert and Ogles in 2004. Now this goes on another two recent analyses of very large numbers of therapists perhaps provide the most definitive evidence about therapists' experience. Wumpold and Brown, who knows who they are, but 2005 found no effects for therapist experience levels, years of practice, when they analyzed the outcomes of 6,146 clients seen by 581 therapists in a managed care setting, which would be a setting like ours. All therapists were post-degree. Similarly, Okashi et al. 2006 found no effects of therapist experience level, pre-internship, internship, post-internship, on the speed of client improvement in their study of more than 5,000 clients seen by 71 therapists at university counseling centers. So what does this mean? Now,
gee, I was ready to ask an important question. So what's your point?
So, you know, we have people who will come here. You know, we have interns who are just starting. Yeah. We have, you know, pre-licensed counselors, and then we have licensed counselors, and we have PhDs. And the general public will say, which is the best counselor? Well, it's certainly not the intern. Now, this is going to be shocking. What this is saying is these categories were not important. So technically, just by chance, and you're a research expert, so weigh in on this, it would be if I give you a PhD or an intern, just on that fact alone, it is not going to be important, regarding the outcome of your counseling.
You hit it right on the button. I'll give you an N of one. Me.
One participant would tell us that.
Me. And sometimes I'm successful, and sometimes I'm not. Yeah. And a lot of it depends on, one, the person's expectations. Another part of it is dependent on their readiness and willingness. It really depends on, my level of acceptance and their level of acceptance. But it's not of me.
Yeah.
It's their acceptance of, they want to go through this change process.
Right. So what you're saying.
The key word is it's a process.
Well, and I would say, and I don't have these articles, Alex, if you can find me the definitive studies in the next 5 minutes, and this will be hard, but we run assessments here. It's an evaluation tool that we use that measures relationship. And, in the Christian community, we have a saying, especially in the evangelical circles, it's not about religion, it's about relationship. That if we don't have a relationship with Jesus Christ, that nothing else matters. And definably, what defines us as Christians is our relationship. Well, let's extrapolate that out into, am I doing counseling? Am I engaged in my counseling? Well, that's dependent on, it's not on EMDR. It's not on, any other technique. So what's the most important technique? It's about relationship. And so the good counselors, whether they're an intern up to whether they're a doctor, do they know how to build the foundational things of relationship, where the counseling, that'll be the foundation of counseling. And that's what the studies will show. That's why these studies are very shocking, is without that, none of these other factors are important. And it's the main effect in how people are going to do all the things that we just talked about, like in their minds and their hearts, how do they start going in the right direction, is they're in relationship with somebody who is helping them.
I had a fellow recently, so we get into what makes a success.
Yeah.
And I had a fellow recently, we really did. I mean, you could tell from the first session. We were having a really good rapport. He really understood the process. Because he was basically dealing with lots of anxiety. Had a little bit of a depressed mood going on and everything. Just wanted to feel better, I guess. And at the end of the session, he said, he made an appointment. He wanted to come back next week. Before next week came, I got a phone call. He said, you know what? I don't want to do all this work. He says, I think I'll just keep things the way they are. Was that a success? He made a decision. It was his choice. And that's what I say, how do you determine
I'm speechless.
How do you determine what's a success? Yeah. And it's like, good.
Yeah, I think, and what I would say here is, I mean, look at all the things that happened through our relationship. I would not be here today if it was not for you. That's the truth. And, I mean, what happened through our relationship was big for me. Like, and sometimes I feel, for you to be able to say that. I mean, and I know, you've always been good to me, but that was big. And
I'll say vice versa. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you.
Yeah. Relationship is a big thing in the counseling. And, we train our counselors from intern to me and you. But there's these things we call the micro skills of counseling, which is we're going to show people, we're going to engage people certainly in a certain way. We train in it, and so I'm going to listen to you. I'm going to listen for your feelings and make sure that you know that. And I'm going to listen for your thoughts. And then we're going to go into this empathy where we make this connection. And people are, you know, God designed us to make this possible, that we can reflect that in a certain way, that we're sort of walking each other's shoes. We're caring at another level. And then there's this final part of empathy that we're going to call intuitive empathy, that you're talking about problems that are upsetting you so much, and that's how people come here. And I'm connected to that. I'm feeling it. I'm those thoughts that are in your mind now are in my mind, and we can recognize that. But because I'm not as close to that as you are, I'm not having to live your life. I'm here to be with you in that. I can see a little bit further into that because I'm not distracted and being pushed around by all those things. And now I can reflect that back to you, this intuitive, like what it must be like. And that helps you see deeper into the choice that you need to make. And all of a sudden you realize in that you're not alone. You know, that you have this relationship, this person, you know, who can help you. And I'd say, like, it might seem very simple, but that is the core of a good counselor. And I have interns who can do that. And I have doctoral people who can do that. And then I know, you know, and I will say, I know counselors outside of CCA who can't do that. And it doesn't matter what they know.
Yeah, and having started as a school counselor, I had janitors who could do that.
And you have bartenders who can do that. Not that I'm telling you to go to a bar. But, you know, and those studies are shown there that it's about the relationship. It's clinical. And then there's all these other things that we look for help. Those relationships are in the church. You know, we can open ourselves to that. And that, you know, I would say that there's a thing that science can't identify that we know is there, is that God is working through those relationships powerfully. Mm-hmm. And that we have to have faith in that to see it.
Yeah. When I think of spirituality, yeah, and whether I'm doing Christian counseling, I don't know what we would call it, secular counseling, whatever, we can get into spirituality. Spirituality being that we're all connected.
Yeah.
You know, we're all connected, the world's connected, and so forth. Well, to me, the Christian counselor says, because we're God's children, you know, we know who our daddy is. And when I think about those kinds of things, you know, and then I go into the old stuff on needs. Well, when I think about needs, we had physical needs, basic needs. You know, water, shelter, food. I don't get those met, I'm probably going to die.
Yeah.
But then I think about emotional needs, recognition, appreciation. What happens when I don't get those met? I'll probably die. It's called depression.
Yeah.
Because I feel alone.
If you don't get those basic needs met, Maslow talked about that hierarchy of needs.
Yeah. But I feel alone because I need other people to appreciate me and recognize me. But so are my spiritual needs, which are, you know, again, we get back to we're all God's children. Well, I need to feel like I'm heard. I need to feel like I'm chosen and I fit in and I belong. Those are the things that lift me up spiritually.
Yeah.
That's where the church can come in.
Amen. Amen. Well, you know, so... I have some updates here. Like there were some other articles here that we wanted to get into, and I just wanted to give the folks an update. You know, we've been here before in the podcast, but I have the health premium reports overprescribed. Let me put that up on the screen. Take a look at that. I don't think that we clearly mentioned this, Joe, but this would be September 8th, this was came out in February 6, 2024. They are having all these, you know, people report that they're taking these psych meds. Because, you know, what's the best, the question becomes, what's the best thing I can do when I'm depressed? And they, I think the general public is aware that we're not allowed to suggest antidepressants to teenagers because it spikes the suicidal ideation and violence. And they started to really watch out for this, and they're seeing it happen in adults also. And so the article lifts up, if you scroll down, says more than 1 in 8 Americans take antidepressants, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And the number likely increased during the pandemic, so it's more than 1 in 8. And many people take antidepressants for off-label uses or uses other than depression, including anxiety and trouble sleeping. The most common antidepressants prescribed for depression are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And it goes on to say that this is a big industry. $15.6 billion worth of this stuff was given out in 2022. And the estimates of people who are being overprescribed for problems is ranging from 20 to 24%, or when you look at certain populations like the elderly, they're consistently overprescribed. More than 24% of the people who are getting scripts are just, it's too much. So as you scroll down, then they go into this, they have a couple of case studies where there were tragic endings. People had committed suicide. They go into the risks of the drug studies, and then they're starting to overturn the original studies of Prozac and Zoloft. So they say that statistically, the drug companies that did the research, it was bad research, that they took out suicides that happened in the groups that were studied, and they took out the subjects for whatever reason. They got them out of there because they didn't have a good effect. And now if we reanalyze the raw data, because people have gone back, and this article goes into this, it's quite amazing that one can, one study was, okay, here's a study of, they took nothing, they took an herb, St. John's wort, or they took the psychiatric medication. The effects were basically the same as if they almost the same as if they didn't take it at all. Has hardly no effect that's good. And then there's these weird effects, like it makes you like really agitated, and that's where people become violent. Or it could really swing your mood into a place where you can't see past an idea to take your life. And, so there's some serious risks. Now, we've always like heard that kind of stuff before, but in these articles, and I have a bunch of them, and the risks here, we've already decided in 2013 to stop going to this students. No youth should take an antidepressant. But now they're starting to understand in adults. The studies that were done were so controversial that we can't even say that they have a positive effect at all now. I mean, that's definitively been shown. Now, I think that this is going to continue to be debated, to be fair, because, the psychiatrists out there who are watching, not happy with this. But that's, there's all these articles that are starting to come out to say, you know what, these drugs are, they really have a lot of risks to them. This is not the best you can do, if that's the question.
And if I just think about the emotional and the spiritual factor. Being depressed is a sense of being stuck. I can't do anything. I'm just stuck in this, and I don't want it, you know, and so forth. And somebody comes along and said, here's this miracle thing. Just take it, and you'll feel better. And
yeah.
I might. But the sense is, am I really dealing with a depression? The depression usually, you know, the best way of dealing with depression is just to do something. You get active and you make a decision, so I'm not stuck. Understand I'm free and I'm not stuck, and I do something. Now, that's when in cases where the depression is something situational. I believe there are organic cases, you know, there's something wrong with hormones or something. And that to me is the value of medication and so forth, and the value of the medical professional that can study those kinds of things. But it's gotten to the point where you know, general practitioner is giving you this because you say you're feeling depressed and something. And, you know.
Yeah, you know, and we say this every time we address this. I mean, this is a good update, and this article, we took it from the Epic Times, and it's called Overprescribed: Suicides Haunt the Dubious Approval of Antidepressants. So what they found in this research analysis was these foundational studies, they concealed the people who committed suicide in the samples, and it would have made the studies be seen generally as ineffective. That's how bad the side effect was. And because the statistical significance of that, you know, was taken out, people misread these studies. And so the original purpose of allowing these things to be prescribed, we now have to change our thinking about it if we're really going to face the truth. And so, you know, I would say that, yes, there's some situations, but, you know, what I would say to those listening today, that if you are the one in eight, or possibly the one in five that are taking an antidepressant, you've been taking it for a long time, you're reflecting on things and you're saying, like, look, I'm really not where they said I was going to be with this.
Yeah.
That you need to connect with us, and we can help you. And now, like, especially the elderly population that stays out of counseling, you know, across Pennsylvania and in all of our other states that we practice, Medicare has just been approved for many of our counselors. And we have other foundation-funded opportunities that make counseling totally affordable. And you can get into this kind of relationship with people who can help unravel that. And what people are finding is these medications have not gotten them there. Now, there is a certain percentage of people who had a good effect, and, you know, okay. And we have psychiatry available at CCA. So we have a good psychiatrist who's not going to overprescribe, and who's really going to what our psychiatrist does is he helps you get off the medication eventually. Sees it as a cast. You wear it for a while, then you take the cast off before the stuff underneath gets too funky.
Right.
You know, because that's what happens when you keep a cast on forever. And,
I was mentioning before with, some things that people were doing before to deal with trauma and so forth. And, you know, I had a good friend who was a psychiatrist. I had a few good friends that were psychiatrists. And they would always, you know, point out some things, especially around anxiety. Just some relaxation techniques that they would rather prescribe that than medication. However, people won't do them.
Yeah.
That's the problem. It was easier to go take a pill because, you know, he taught us things like some deep breathing techniques or, you know, just some meditation tech. It was all kinds of series of just relaxation.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I remember him telling me, he says, you know, the human mind can only focus, if you're truly focused, The human mind can only focus on one thing at a time. And if you're focused on your anxiety, that's what's going to happen. But if you focus on something else, like your breathing or the surroundings or whatever, you won't be able to focus on your anxiety.
Yeah.
And then recently, I think it was a journal of the American Medical Association was showing that relaxation techniques are just as effective as medication for anxiety and trauma.
Yeah. And we can, you know, given this batch of studies that's examined, I think very credibly, you can see why that would be. And I would tell you that, I mean, I go back to that dichotomy of, are we seeking symptom reduction or are we seeking well-being and facing our lives? Well, you know, we've had people that we removed the symptom of trauma, you know, through EMDR or, you know, through a good round of counseling. And that's just the beginning. You know, there's other more important things now that we need to face. But people are like, hey, you know, I'm done. Because I was just looking for the symptom to be removed, and they've gone on to ignore some things that really gave them problems in their life that we could help them with. Yeah. And so, you know, so I'd say to everybody out there that, you know, if you were to take away that, you know, from this, you know, to really consider, you know, that approach, you know, instead of symptom reduction, always be counseling. and that doesn't mean to, you know, to be here forever, but to make this a lifestyle of facing.
I just want to go, you know, before we break up here, is just to go back to one of my favorites. I pointed out Philippians before, but you know, long before Christ, maybe about 600 years, they were writing about anxiety. And if I look at Ecclesiastes, that third chapter, you know, there's a time for this, a time for that. God will determine what that time is, you know. So who are we to be worried about, and you know, and all that. Although he points out, I love it, at the end of that chapter, he points out, but you know, God did create anxiety too. He says, and human beings tend to want to use it. And but you know, he talked about how meaningless that is, you know, because it's God that is really going to, you know, decide how things are going to go.
Yeah. Well, anything else we want to get into?
I don't know.
Well, let me say, Joe, thanks for coming today.
Okay.
Really appreciate talking with you. And if you have if you ever have anything else you want to come in and talk about, you know, now you know about the podcast.
Yeah.
You can come on.
Yeah, this was an education for me. I didn't even know what a podcast was.
That's like, you know. Again, on these days, we just want to throw out questions that we think, you know, might be interesting. And also, you know, just share how we're doing.
Okay.
And talk about stuff that we're interested in. But let me say a prayer for the folks.
Okay.
And we'll end here. Lord, I give you thanks for having Joe here today and the relationship that we have. And we give you thanks at Easter time. Lord, for your sacrifice that allows us to have relationship with you, and everything that we can celebrate on this high holy day of Easter, we praise you and thank you for it. I pray for all those who would be asking questions out there about, you know, what is the best way to seek help. Lord, let them find you in all of the chaos. Let us see through that, to see that we can have a relationship with you. We ask for that blessing for Joe and I, and for all those who listen. And we pray this all in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
Thanks for being with us, folks. We'll see you next time.